My Bloody Horrorcast.
Episode 6.
I know. You know what, Steph? We finally made it. We finally made episode 6. I'll bet people thought, all of our devoted listeners, probably thought that there would never be another episode for all they knew.
There will always be another episode, but there might be a huge lapse in between them.
Exactly. No, that's a good point. We're going to be here. We're not going anywhere. And we thank all of you who have waited patiently for episode 6.
Yeah. So we're finally going to talk about serial killers, sort of. We're going to talk about Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer and a little bit of Serial Mom.
Two movies that are almost kind of at the end of the spectrum, opposite ends. But there's some tie-ins as well about those movies, which is fun.
I'm interested to hear your tie-ins.
Yes, yes, yes.
Do you want to talk about what we've been watching recently?
Yeah, I mean, we've had a good 3-4 week break between everything. So, actually, would you mind? Because you've seen a lot more than me during this break.
I've watched 45 movies since the last time we hung out that are horror-based. But
yes, that may be a record, Steph. I'm just saying, we need to talk to...
I don't have a lot of friends, Carrie. I watch a lot of movies. but I guess I'll just touch on a few that I'd been excited to see and had not seen before, because I did a lot of rewatches in there.
And I may jump in on some of those as well.
Okay. Sure. So first, I just want to say really quick, episode 8 of Twin Peaks was so good. Did you watch it yet?
Okay, so we're 2 back. Tonight, we're catching up with 6 and 7. We're 2 back because my group of friends, we couldn't all get together at the right times, but now we're all like, you know, in sync each week. So I still have to watch 6 and 7. We're behind the rest of the, you know, the known world. So 8 maybe this week. We may have a special extra night this week just to watch 8 because the internet has been blown up. Facebook has been blown up all week. Ever since last Sunday.
Reading everything I can find about it. I had an actual nightmare after watching it.
Oh yeah. All right. It worked.
And my friend had a nightmare too, and she'd actually sent me a message like right before we got to watch it. She's like, I had a nightmare after watching this. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then Dean and I watched it, and I also had a nightmare. it's awesome.
Well, that's a great duality of Twin Peaks, because I remember watching the first season and having a nightmare. The first time where you see Bob starts to get really nasty midway through season 1.
Oh, yeah.
I definitely had a couple nights, yeah.
Totally.
Walking by a mirror.
Oh, I know. Yeah, we're just thinking he's going to be crouched in your room. Anyway.
Yep. There you go.
Just really quick, some other things. I finally saw The Girl with All the Gifts, which I really, really liked.
Okay.
I can't remember if I mentioned that last time. I watched Southbound, which is a horror anthology.
Did you see where it came out? No, I've had recommended. You know, we're our as of yet unpublished anthology episode. That was on my list, but I never actually watched it, but I had it recommended by a couple friends.
Throw it in there. I enjoyed it.
Yeah? Okay.
Any
notable directors in there?
I feel bad that I can't remember, but I do know one of the guys who's behind like the VHS movies and XX. I don't know if he helped produce it or something, but there are some familiar hands in the mix. And there's a cool cult segment that I really liked.
Okay.
I watched Baskin for the first time. I had not seen it before. Have you seen this movie? It came out a couple years ago. It was pretty hyped up.
It's on my list. Turkish horror.
Yeah. Turkish
delight?
Psychedelic nightmare. No, the opposite of delight. Like, pretty much just in the opening where cops are, like, joking around about bestiality. I'm like, ooh, I already know this stomach's gonna hurt my guts. Or this movie's gonna hurt my guts.
And it did.
It did. Yeah, it's,
Is it like over the top gross out fest, which the commercial or the preview rather made me think over the top gore fest?
It's kind of beautiful. It's a little bit Hellraiser, but maybe if like Refn directed it.
Art house.
Yeah, it's kind of artsy. And it's cool and it's dreamy, but it's cool.
What do you think of it though overall?
Oh, I like it. I want everybody to watch it. I recommended it to your former coworker Larry Tenner.
Oh, Larry.
And he's just like, they open up with a bestiality talk. And I'm like, yeah. Then I watched Grim Prairie Tales, which I also want to throw in our anthology episode. It's a 1990 movie with Brad Dourif and James Earl Jones.
Brad Dourif, the king of early 90s horror.
They're like these two guys, like westward bound, swapping scary stories. It's great.
Okay.
It's a western in
Grim anthology. Fairy tales. So would this be something that before we do our as of yet unreleased and as of yet unrecorded anthology episode that should be watched, or is this a, would this be a necessary entry, or is it just a fun one?
It's just a fun one.
Okay.
But I was pleasantly surprised that it existed.
Okay. All right.
There just aren't a lot of horror Western anthologies out there.
That's very true. I agree. Yeah.
And then I guess the last ones I'd want to mention are, I watched Psycho 2 and 4. I loved them. I watched It Comes at Night. Also loved it. I think A24, their hipster downbeat horror. Very cool. And then I watched 47 Meters Down because we're recording this right before the 4th of July. So I've got a lot of sharks on the brain.
And, you know, maybe next year we'll do a shark episode.
Yeah.
I think in anticipation of next, you know, next summer's summer blockbuster season, you know, everyone's in the water at the beach, we should definitely do that.
Oh, totally.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe like a beach and shark mix. That'd
I
be
like
fun.
That.
I do not recommend 47 Meters Down, actually.
No.
I had a lot of fun watching it because I watched it with a hilarious friend, but I don't know if I actually thought it was good or not. I actually got really upset about the ending.
Okay, now, again, a good horror movie should elicit emotion, right? Ideally. Mm. But upset in a bad way, or?
Yes, I was upset at the writing.
Ah, that's bad.
And the plot itself.
That's not good. That's not good.
Mandy Moore's pretty good, though. And the sharks are awesome.
I think Mandy Moore's a pretty good actress. I mean, I haven't seen her in a lot. I mean, I think I was forced to watch A Walk to Remember many years ago with Keanu Reeves.
No, you're mixing up two things. Walk to Remember is where she has cancer, but it's a young male actor, and they're in high school.
But it's Mandy Moore.
Keanu Reeves is a Walk in the Clouds.
A Walk in the Clouds. There you go. Okay. But one of those movies I was forced to watch, and now they're both, yeah, it could be either one.
It's A Walk to Remember. Weirdly, I was also forced to watch that movie. Did not enjoy it.
No, whatever movie I saw with one of the two of them, or both of them potentially, or neither of them, it was terrible. So, whichever movie that might have been.
Keanu Reeves is ageless. He easily could have been a high school student pursuing Mandy Moore. Anyway.
Sure, that would work. God. And consider, and just on the quick tangent, his performance in John Wick, the first John Wick, is nothing short of one of the best action performances we've seen in the last 20 years. We'll just say that.
I was not disappointed in John Wick 2 either. I really loved both.
I really, really liked the first one because I felt like it was a near-perfect action movie. When you expand so much, like in the second one, I felt there were some things that didn't work for me.
Mm.
But also, again, we're going to John Wick here. Common was completely misused.
I do think he was underused.
The big flub of the movie is that Common should have been, could have and should have been either the, you know, a truly great antagonist, or one of those kind of roles where, you know, might be an antagonist, might be a protagonist, you don't really know, that could have shifted. Totally left out of the movie. Big disappointment. Other than that, John Wick 2 is good.
Yeah.
So I really have seen very little. I did see It Comes at Night. We talked about that. We talked about both going to see it. I think that the acting in It Comes at Night is great. Joel Edgerton's fantastic. I thought the newcomer, who I'm going to forget his name right now, but I'm going to look it up. So,
the neighbor or their teen son?
The teen son.
Oh, yeah.
He is so good. He does a great job. Like, it really is sort of a coming-of-age story as well as a post-apocalyptic, you know, drama. More of a drama. I don't really think of it necessarily as a horror film. Kelvin Harrison Jr., this kid's fantastic. He's great. I hope that he gets some more roles. I hope we see him in some other things. I thought he was great. Carmen Ejogo, also, she's great in everything she does.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that the writing was also very good. Cinematography is great. The movie at the end sort of left me a little underwhelmed. Not that I didn't like it. Not that I didn't get what he was trying to do. I think that I probably fell into, like a lot of people, seeing the trailer and expecting a different movie than the trailer puts out.
That trailer is cut to make it look like much more of a horror movie.
When right.
It's just a lot more like building paranoia
than
straight up horror. I still think it's a horror movie.
I think it's effective in building the paranoia. I do agree. I think, like I said, there were things that I felt like I wanted more than I got from the film. Whereas when I watched The Witch at first, I felt the same way about The Witch. I went back and thought about The Witch more, and I felt like The Witch actually works exactly as it is. And they didn't really need to do anything different. And this one, it comes at night. Here I am a month later after watching it, or no, maybe a couple weeks. And I still feel underwhelmed. I still feel like there's something that made the movie incomplete for me.
Ooh.
Maybe it's that it tries to be a number of different things, and I don't feel like it necessarily completely delivers on all those things. But I think that Trey Edward Schultz, or Schutz, is obviously a good director. He's director and screenwriter of this film. And I am interested to see what he does following this movie.
I hadn't seen his other movie, but...
Krisha, I think, is the other one.
Yeah. But I'm also excited to see what he does next. I loved this movie. I thought it was very simple, and I thought it did accomplish the things it was going for.
No, that's, I mean, that's fair.
I also, now when I see A24, I'm just like, okay, I feel like I know what type of mood you're going for with your movies.
You know, and I've liked a lot of A24 stuff. I think that they are sort of the indie answer to what Blumhouse is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Blumhouse has definitely become like the most prolific horror slash thriller film production company out there right now. But A24 is really doing the, you know, it's the thinking person's horror, if you want to call that. It's the art house horror. They're doing it a little bit. Blumhouse has now started out like that, and now they've gotten a little more mainstream. Yeah. I think A24 is sticking with that, you know?
But they've got a lot of, like, moody, slow burn stuff. And I don't know. I'm into it. I like it a lot. But I am usually a gentler judge on things.
It depends on the movie. Hey, there's some movies, you know. I don't know. But yes, yeah, maybe overall, yes. Okay, so serial killer movies.
Yeah.
We've talked about doing this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And when I told you that I hadn't seen Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, you nearly fell on the floor.
I know.
And you were right, because it's on there's a short list of movies that I should have seen long ago, right? And Henry is basically at the top of this list of movies I should have seen. So
my should have seen list goes on forever.
It's crazy. I know, yeah. I mean, you know, we're only human, right? Mm-hmm. We can only see what we can see. And in between those things, I might be, you know, I might have to watch a little Parks and Rec here and there. which I'm on season 3, it's a lot of fun. So, but Henry's at the top of the list. And when we talked about doing serial killers, I thought this was a perfect opportunity for me to see it. And I know you would want to go back and see it because it had been a long time, right? I mean,
yes, I had not seen it. I guess I saw it kind of recently. It got a 30-year re-release a couple years ago, so I did watch it again. I don't know why. I've seen this movie 3 times, and the 2 times after the first time I watched it, I'm like, oh, still a good movie. Don't know why I watched it again. Not a particularly fun movie.
It's not. I mean...
I still love it, though.
You know, movies don't have to be fun, necessarily, to be great, to be brilliant, to be classic, whatever.
But why I've seen this movie and Irreversible more than once, kind of beyond me. I did not need to rewatch either.
Well, you know, if something is that shocking the first time, you want to watch it again. You want to see, am I going to experience the same shock and feeling the first time?
Mm-hmm.
You also want to see, like, I think with movies like a Henry, and I've only seen it once, so I need to watch it again. I think when you see a movie like that, you're really experiencing it for the first time. You're not looking at a lot of the small aspects of the little things that are thrown in there, and I think the second time gives you that. So I feel like that's a movie that would benefit from that.
Are you impressed as hell, though, that this was, like, this director's first feature film and Michael Rooker's incredible screen debut?
I mean, so Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, this movie was filmed in 86. It did not get a theatrical release for 3 years.
Oh.
Should
have known you'd looked up the factoids.
You know me, right? So it turns out that the film's producers didn't know what to do with it and didn't really like it. So they'd hired John McNaughton, you know, to do this film. And originally they wanted it to be this, you know, I think in the vein, kind of catching on or bringing back the vein of, you know, Big Jason and all these big 80s serial killer movies, you know. But they were like silly, invincible monsters.
Right.
You know, I think that one thing we can probably agree on is that really, if you get to the end of the Jason cycle and Jason Goes to Hell, he's become a monster not unlike Mummy, Dracula, Wolfman. Oh. He's become like a Hammer or Universal creation, you know? And so John McNaughton read this, at that time, Henry Lee Lucas, the serial killer.
I did read it was based on him.
Yeah, so he had just read some stuff. Henry Lee Lucas was in the press for some reason. I forget exactly what.
Well, supposedly he killed over 300 people, although a lot of cops say.
Well, actually, over time that's all been debunked. He wanted it because he wanted the fame and fortune, because serial killers are usually, you know, insanely narcissistic. Mm-hmm. And so he wanted the coverage. Plus, each time that happened, he got even more removed from the prison population, which is what he wanted, because he was worried, because he was also a rapist and, he's a terrible, a truly despicable human being. So he wanted to be as far away from the prison population as possible. So him saying, sure, I killed 300 people, that's going to get you in solitary confinement for a long time. So the director, John McNaughton, is reading about this movie. He says, I want to go a different way. So he filmed Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer as realistic as he could. And wow, how well that worked.
Oh my God. Yeah. I was rewatching it this morning over breakfast, which was a mistake.
Steph, that's why I love you. That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing.
It's just such a depressing, no frills depiction of murders. And I was thinking about how, like, Henry's sort of the complete opposite of any other killer. Like, not just, like, franchise, like, Jason's and Freddy's, but, like, he's no charming Hannibal Lecter. He's not, like, a smart, charismatic killer. He's this very, like, simple, compulsive, like, monster.
He has no interest in trying to really charm you, even. We look back at a lot of these serial killers, the Charles Manson, the Henry Lee Lucases. These were people, again, who were very charismatic, who wanted to charm and fool the people around them. Henry doesn't seem to care about that at all. The impression of the movie, I guess, that all times he is trying to hide and push down this, you know, insatiable desire to just kill everybody. And so, in every moment, in every moment, you get this seething, like, you know, desire beneath him that is just, you can see in every movement, you can hear it, and when he speaks, it's really impressive, a performance from Michael Rooker. I mean,
it's like a low-budget movie, and the actors really are great.
They're fantastic. I mean, everybody. Tom Towles, who plays Otis, is a... You don't realize how bad Otis is until later in the film. You know he's bad.
Realized he was pretty bad.
When I finally saw it, I was like, obviously this guy's a lecherous, sick, sick person. And then one of the pivotal scenes near the end, you realize, no, he actually is going to carry through on these things. It's not just he has these desires, like, he has the willpower to go through with it.
Just the motivation of both of them as killers is really unique. Like, it's just such a... there's, like, no ceremony at all. It's like two bros on a killing spree, but in, like, the worst, worst way. I think in many ways Otis is more repugnant than Henry, just in that, I don't know, I was still kind of hoping, like, maybe there's, like, a shred of humanity in Henry, and he and Becky are gonna, like, end up together.
That's exactly what McNaughton wanted to do. It's what's so brilliant about the movie. He doesn't even give us that.
But there's no, like, police intrigue or anything. Like, they are not really concerned about... They're like, oh, don't make any two murders similar, but they don't really care. There are no cops after them.
No, they live in this lawless world where the seedy underbelly of society, where you'd see no police. There's one scene where you see a cop car the entire movie. The rest of the time, you don't see it at all, you know? Mm-hmm. It's things like that that it just... It's one of the bleaker horror films, or just films in general, I've ever seen. So, also, you know me, Michael Rooker was in character the entire time.
That's terrifying.
He had a separate dressing room. He didn't talk to anybody. His wife was pregnant. She decided not to tell him that she was pregnant until after the filming of the movie, because he was in such a state at all times when he'd go home. And he would try to decompress, but then he'd be back the next day in character always. How frightening would that be?
Ooh, very frightening. I did not know Michael Rooker was a method actor.
Yeah, evidently. Wow. So this, you know, they filmed this thing for $110,000. It's nothing.
Incredible.
They filmed it for nothing. He was a janitor. Michael Rooker was a janitor when the movie was filmed.
Shit.
Yeah. So,
Is he from Chicago?
I don't know if he's from Chicago. That's a good question. But And I honestly, I think it was just a cold, like, I don't think he and McNaughton knew each other as far as I can tell.
Ooh, well, really quick, I did read the Roger Ebert review of this movie. It's the only review I read before recording today.
Ah.
He said, the director McNaughton is a one-time Chicago ad executive who dropped out of work in a to be in a traveling carnival, build sailboats in New Orleans, and 10 bar in a South Suburban Homewood.
That's fantastic.
I know. That's so cool.
So you're totally going to do a movie about a serial killer, obviously, if you're living that life. No, it's great. You know, he's done some other things. He also did one of my favorite CD films, Wild Things.
No!
That was him.
Like Neve Campbell, Denise Richards, Matt Dillon, Kevin Bacon?
Yeah. To all our listeners out there, if you want to see a great, like, seedy, you know, but kind of still Hollywood actor type movie from the late 90s, Wild Things is just ridiculous and awesome. It knows exactly what it is.
That's a really fun movie.
And it totally, it wants to be ridiculous and crazy and fun, and it totally is. So this director is capable of doing that. no, Henry is one of the more disturbing horror films that I've seen, personally.
Oh, absolutely.
It's one... And it may be one of the greatest performances by an actor in a horror film that I've ever seen. It's one of the greats. Michael Rooker is one of the greats.
I wonder if it's the best, like, debut role I can think of for anyone. It's just so good.
I think the reason that he didn't become a star after this is that the movie is so bleak. It's so grainy and nasty. There's a 3-year delay. All those things, I think, factor into why Rooker... he got a lot of roles off this movie. There's no doubt. I mean, he got his roles in 8 Men Out and all that. But he never became like a big time actor. He's always been a great character actor ever since then. Mm-hmm. The movie did help. Now, I will say this. It did help him get those roles after that. And everything has gotten since. And the fact that he was in Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2, two of the biggest movies to come out of America each year they're released, is pretty awesome. I love to see an actor get like the opportunity to do a big film like that, you know?
Me too. I love seeing Michael Rooker.
Yeah, where he gets a good payday, but it's also a good film as well, you know?
So the other thing that really stood out to me rewatching Henry this morning was I always feel bad for Becky, but the first time I watch it, I'm like, this girl's an idiot. You know what I mean? But now I'm watching it, I'm like, she is the ultimate victim. Like, she was abused by her father. She's getting out of a bad marriage. And then she falls for the worst possible rebound of all time.
Of all time. Right. I mean, this is, you know, it doesn't get worse than that. No.
Her brother is like a gross garbage person. Like, her life is so depressing.
No, it's funny you said earlier about who is worse, Otis or Henry. Otis might actually be worse.
It's hard to tell.
Because Otis enjoys defiling his victims. He takes great pleasure in the family scene.
When they're watching the recording of where they torture and kill that family, that is one of the creepiest, most unsettling scenes in the movie.
They filmed, they were going to do more. They were going to go further with that scene. They didn't. It was going to include necrophilia, which they did not do. But they were right. I mean, it basically does, but they were going to make it more pronounced. And then McNaughton was like, pull it back a little bit. Yeah.
this is where I draw the line. Right. Upsetting film.
But I mean, no, you're right. That's what's interesting about the movies. Compare, like, near the end of the film, we start to see Otis is the bad guy. And for a brief moment, Henry feels like the protagonist, briefly, compared to Otis, is in a way.
I think it's just human nature. You want to find the good in somebody. Sure. But with Otis, there's nothing.
There's nothing.
And it turns out with Henry, there's nothing either. But no. You kind of hope there's going to
no,
be.
No, there isn't, but you thought maybe. But no, you get the sense that Henry, in this movie, he's going to kill somebody. It's going to be awful. But Otis is going to do some things first. Like, Otis is going to go scorched earth. And the scene with Otis and his sister is really disturbing.
Oh, another thing that totally went over my head the previous times I'd watched it. Did you notice, like, does Otis just have, like, this homoerotic admiration for Henry?
He totally does.
Like, it's very, like, this time I couldn't help but, like, keep noticing it. And I'm just like, oh.
No, Otis is all fucked up. Like, Otis doesn't know what he wants, what he is, anything. Like, no, I thought there was, I mean... He's got this, I think there is an underlying, like, respect or admiration that borders into homoeroticism, but also he wants to have sex with his sister. So, I mean, Otis is a a really screwed up guy. One of the more screwed up characters you'll see on film.
But he, like, respects Henry, at least for most of the film.
I think he does. I think Otis is probably a guy who never had a father figure, right?
He does not respect ladies.
No, he's an awful human being when it comes to women. He's a truly despicable misogynist. But you get the sense that he almost looks at Henry as... Maybe Otis hasn't had a lot of male friends, or female friends, that matter. But he almost... I think he considers Henry a friend, probably the closest thing that Otis is capable of having. I think Henry... probably considers Otis a friend as capable as he is of having a friend. Oof. But I also think Henry despises Otis at the very same time and tolerates him because of the situation, but they know each other for a long time. So,
oh, that's right. Yeah,
yeah, so they've been friends for a while. So, I mean, I think literally those are the... Each one is a friend to the other in a way that probably no one else has been.
Also, I can't even remember if I already said that. I don't know if I'm going around in circles, but he gets casually into killing. Like, he just, like, falls into it, like...
No, he totally does.
I guess this is what I'm doing now.
No, you have, we didn't get into that completely. We started to, but no, you went further with it, and you're totally right. He does. Henry is sort of like... he's like the tutor. You know, during this killing spree, it's bizarre. No, I mean... The scene, I mean, again, we've both seen so much that it takes a lot to shock us, you know? And I was definitely disturbed by this film. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt. And especially not having seen it before, I can't imagine how disturbed I would have been, you know, being, you know, what, 18, 19 years old watching this movie, you know? And now, you know, I still am. The MPAA said of this film, when they were talking with McNaught, and McNaught was saying, what cuts can I make to avoid an X rating? The MPAA said... to paraphrase, there's nothing you can do, really, to avoid an X rating. There's really nothing.
Which, by today's standards, is kind of shocking. Like, I personally think I've seen stuff on TV that's, like, more gruesome. Although, maybe it's, like, paired with the tone.
I think it's the subject matter and the tone. I think the graininess of that movie... Mm. Makes it feel more real. It feels like you're watching a bad documentary, or like a documentary that you just unearthed, like in VHS or something like that, you know? I think that contributes to it. I think the tone is huge in this film, and to why it's so... There's very little music. Everything's washed out, grays. Lots of scenes are... a lot of the scenes are, you know, done in lots of shadow. Every setting is seedy. They're in the, you know, going to get the TV, the $50 TV, you know, and there's some warehouse where this guy is selling TVs at midnight, you know?
I feel like whenever they're driving around, it's always, it's like, is this city nothing but hooker alleys? Like, that's
yeah,
what it feels
yeah.
like.
Yeah, yeah. They're basically living in Gotham before Batman got there, I think, is like what the deal is, you know? No, I mean, it's, one other quick thing I won't get too much into. So, the pivotal rape scene, the truly awful rape scene, Becky actually passed out while this was happening. While he was, like, trying to strangle her. Ugh. She passed out. So that's how, like, that's another thing about this movie, you know. You got Michael Rooker in character. You got a character who passes out in a scene from being choked. Like, in real life. Like, not that he... I don't think the set was out of control by any stretch. I mean, everyone was actually, I think... the actors, aside from Michael Rooker, were all very much... had to be very in tune because the scenes were really... personal
not
and very
a set
intimate.
You would walk on and be like, good vibes here.
No. I think you'd... No. So yeah, I think it's probably... It's one of the great horror films of all time, I would say. It actually... And especially if you're looking at the serial killer genre, it's got to be up there, right?
We got to come up with our own personal all-time favorite horror movies.
Ooh, I like that. We need to. Because I have a list of, like, my favorites by decade.
Yeah.
But I haven't compiled that into a full list.
Well,
and I've done that for a long time.
Cut out the obvious and just, like, try to think of things that we would recommend to people.
Sure. No. So, as a quick segue, do you have anything else?
No, please, segue. Okay.
So, as a quick segue from Henry to Serial Mom, I watched Serial Mom today. And early in the movie, Matthew Lillard, who's a huge horror buff...
He's this awesome video clerk.
Yes.
I wish that store still existed, and I wish I had that Death Becomes Her display.
Yes. Oh, my God. It's, you know, it's amazing. It harkens back to the good old days of the old VHS. And Matthew Lillard mentions Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer and says, oh, it's my favorite movie.
Really? Oh,
so it's the duality, it's the yin and yang of our episode today, from Henry to Serial Mom.
I remember that he watches like Texas Chainsaw at some point, but
he does. And there's I think it's 10,000 Maniacs as well, or 2,000 Maniacs.
Really?
Yeah. Cool. 10,000 Maniacs, not the Natalie Merchant Man, but the Herschel Gordon Lewis Gore Fest. Yeah. So Serial Mom, John Waters, 94.
Mm-hmm.
This is after John Waters has truly achieved mainstream cred and success.
It came out after Hairspray.
Mm-hmm. So he's had Hairspray, he's had Crybaby, which were two his two biggest mainstream films, and still today are, right? Nothing has ever approached that, and still done in his style. What's great is you can't say that Waters ever sold out. He never really sold out.
But now, they are more mainstream.
They are more mainstream.
I would watch Serial Mom, Crybaby, or Hairspray with my mom. I would not watch Pink Flamingos or like all sorts of other movies with her.
No, you're right. But I think he managed to do them. Like, he toned down all the sexual, all the crazy sexual stuff. Still manages to make them weird and fun.
That's true.
You just take out the sexual elements, basically.
They always have a good John Waters feel to them.
Yeah. So you had been talking about Serial Mom for a while, and I realized that was missing also in my can of horror films, and it was perfect for this episode. So Kathleen Turner, right after she has hit her peak as a film star before this movie, and like what? V.I. Warshawski, 91, was a huge bust. It was supposed to be a Kathleen Turner franchise. She's a PI in the movie. Oh. It was a huge box office bust. And after that, that was the apex of everything. But Serial Mom is her last, I think, like truly memorable role, as far as I could tell. So, you've got Sam Waterston from Law & Order. You got Matthew Lillard, you got Ricky Lake, and you got Kathleen Turner as the little nuclear family.
You've got a bunch of John Waters' usuals too, like Mink Stole is like the neighbor that she keeps like prank calling.
Yes.
And then
I love those scenes are so great.
They're so great. I love when they're like at their other neighbor's house and she like smashes the Fabergé egg and like blames her, and she has the whole Pussy Willows thing.
It's like she's so brazen. She's just baiting her, and this poor woman just isn't that sharp, and really isn't able to come back at her. And so she just is sort of like just clueless the whole time, and just allows herself to be sort of browbeaten. It's really funny.
I'm really kicking myself for not rewatching this like I planned. Like, I'm dying to see it now that it's gotten that like Scream Factory release. But I totally...
No, I would love to see that version.
Mm-hmm.
I've not seen that version.
Yeah, I mean, I totally remember like Mink Stole wearing like the double denim and just like
so good.
Getting baited in the court scene. Oh, it's awesome.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's great. Kathleen Turner's great. She's hilarious. She's so funny in that movie.
You know what though? I was thinking at first I was going to compare this to Santa Clarita Diet in the sense that it's kind of this suburban like satire, but I actually think she plays it a little less over the top. Like, her character is nuts, but she's really not as crazy as she could be. She's certainly not that tongue-in-cheek about a lot of things.
No. I think she does a really good job. Okay, she's very much like Henry. Very much like Henry's character in Henry Porter's Soap Killer. She can't stop. And I think there's obviously no mistake that remark is made early in the film, because she is basically, I mean, they are kindred spirits. She is just able to put on the face a little bit better than Henry.
Oh.
And
she's way better.
Like the perfect, like, you know, the platinum look, you know. No, she's she does a great job of it. But she also has such an insatiable desire to kill. There are times where she goes from one murder scene and just has to go to the next one because she, you know, if one little thing throws her off, it's like, oh, gotta go.
This is also one of the first, I guess, more of a horror comedy than anything else, but one of the first kind of horror things that I think I got to see while it was still like new, like growing up.
And I loved
the fire poker death. I thought it was like the best.
Yes. I love the turkey leg.
Oh my god, the
death
Annie
by
woman.
Turkey leg. Yeah.
Oh, the I was reading up out. On it. I had no idea that there was like a Bill Cosby joke in that movie, like pre Bill Cosby rape. She's just like, she's returning like ghost dad, and yes, she loves Bill Cosby movies. And I'm like, oh, even that plays for another joke now.
Yes, it does. Oh, John Waters, you're a brilliant man. It's just such a fun movie. I don't know if Andrew likes it. Our friend Andrew Scherer, obviously Cinephile Podcast.
Oh, I hope he does.
Is a massive John Waters fan. I figure he probably did, but I would be curious to what Andrew, who is a true John Waters like devotee, I would say. This guy knows everything. I mean, John Waters is probably, I think Andrew's probably biggest influence in film, I would say. Especially looking at his own films.
I have to confess, I've never seen Andrew Shearer's films. I need to. I'm going to my first Gonzerific this year.
Oh, yeah. So our buddy Andrew does Gonzerific. It's short, usually horror-themed films. And there's obviously it's got to be. I mean, John Waters. So I would love to see what Andrew thinks about it. Maybe in a future episode we'll pose that question to him about where Serial Mom ranks in his favorite Waters films.
Right. Were you sympathetic to any of the things that, like, set Beverly off to murder? Because I also feel a near homicidal rage when I see people willfully refusing to recycle.
Well, here's the great thing about the movie. I think it's universal in that we all think those things at times, right? We all say that, sure. We fly into a rage, you know, like, we see somebody, you know, her daughter's getting cheated on. You know, she's like, oh, I want to kill that guy. Oh, I'm going to kill him. We say that in jest, but in this movie, she does all those things we always say in jest. She actually does them.
We're like a garbage disposal man level where she's talking to them and they're like joking about it. But yeah, she's not just all talk. She's action.
And the thing about John Waters is in his movies, he celebrates the freaks. Mm-hmm. He celebrates the people who are not the top of the food chain, the one percenters. And so she loves the garbage men. The garbage men are like friends of hers.
I know.
And they become crucial. They actually help. They allow her to escape in the church scene.
Oh, good. She's taking them like little midday drinks.
Yeah. See, she doesn't mind. I think what Kathleen, and probably what John Waters is trying to say, that what he hates, and actually it's also hypocritical because she's the same way also, but she hates, you know, these people who should know better. They have all the reasons, all the things, all the tools to do better, and yet they don't. Mm-hmm. She does as well, so it's really a hypocritical kind of thing. But I think that she goes after those people. I feel like the people who they know better, they have the resources, and yet they still are doing. Throw out the recycling, you know, in the trash or what have you, you know.
Yeah, they're not rewinding their VHSs.
But no, it takes all those little annoyances of life and sort of blows it up. But what if you actually did those things you say, like, you know, and Kathleen Turner does. And so it's a very cathartic film in that way. You know, it's kind of fun without having to actually do those things and do those terrible things that she does, because she is a truly a terrible person. this allows you to sort of have fun and imagine what if.
But she's hilarious.
She's great.
And awesome. Kathleen Turner's so good.
She's so good in this movie. She sells the movie completely and wholeheartedly.
Was this movie a success? I don't even know. I was so young.
It was, I mean, it made some money. None of John Waters' films, though, like when he started, so I know later in his career with what, Cecil B. Demented, Pecker, Dirty Shame, none of those films made much money in the box office. They were almost always did not recoup their budget. But you know, John Waters' movies aren't meant for the mainstream anyway. They're really not.
I feel like this one was.
Well, I mean, there's a few. Crybaby is. Mm-hmm. Hairspray is. And this one could. And this one is. When you go before and after that, these three movies, I don't really. It's kind of. Pecker, I mean, was fairly. I guess it's fairly normal.
Yeah, I remember when A Dirty Shame came out. It's like one of the only John Waters movies I've gotten to see in theaters.
And see, I actually never saw Dirty Shame.
Oh, well. Definitely not meant for the masses, but I enjoyed it. I actually even like Johnny Knoxville. I think he's really funny.
I think Knoxville actually is a pretty competent actor, a pretty decent actor. He's obviously typecast because, you know, his Jackass stuff, but he's good. He's a good actor. What's your favorite John Waters film?
Oh, Female Trouble. Oh, Polyester. I don't know. It's hard to choose, Carrie. Maybe Serial Mom. If it's a movie that I think I could put on and show the most people and enjoy it, it would probably be either Crybaby or Serial Mom.
Yeah. I remember watching Crybaby and Hairspray as a kid and thinking they were both really fun and colorful and, you know, really enjoyed them. I still have to see a couple of his, the earliest ones. Like, I haven't seen Mondo Trasho.
Oh, I haven't either. I haven't seen...
And I haven't seen,
I haven't seen most of his early shorts. Also, I don't even know if they're available.
This is where Andrew Shearer would probably disown us as friends, because we haven't seen John Waters' best films, evidently. But Pink Flamingos, of course, is... Pink Flamingos and Polyester are the only two I've seen of his pre-1982 stuff. Because he only had like 5 or 6 movies during that time.
Have you seen Female Trouble?
I haven't, actually.
Christmas time. We've got to watch it. There's a great scene involving a Christmas tree in Cha-Cha Hills.
Well, we've talked about doing a Christmas episode, and I think we have to do that this year, because there are too many good Christmas horror movies not to. There really are. We've got to do it this year.
We've missed all the other holidays except for Halloween and Christmas.
Well, Steph, damn it, we can do this. I believe in us and our ability to do this. I really do. Where does Serial Mom sit for you? It's a horror movie, but it's also a comedy. I mean...
Yeah, it's just a black comedy. I think it's a horror comedy. I mean... Yeah, they don't skimp on the gore.
No.
With their deaths.
No, they don't.
Although Beverly does not like blood.
No. No, she doesn't. You're right. The poker death scene is great. Her expressions as she's trying to pull off the the body parts from the end of it are really just great.
That's awesome.
What was that? Was that the spleen she's trying to pull off the end of it, or
I don't know. What she stuck something in his middle was pulled out.
Something in the middle. Maybe a little lower intestine. Maybe a little upper intestine. We don't know. But it's it's a lot of fun, and I'm really glad that you mention that for this series.
Next year, though, Mother's Day films.
We'll give it another mention then. You know, Steph, we're new at this. We're rookies. We're just rookies living in a podcast world. And so we've got, you know, this year is our year of kind of, you know, getting into it. Next year we can kind of hit our stride, you know.
Perfect. All right. Well, I do not know when we're recording again or what it'll be, but it'll hopefully be sooner than the gap between this and the last episode.
We're hoping so. And hopefully, and of course, as always, we'll be talking about some awesome movies. So that's a guarantee. So I guess that's a wrap for episode 6.
Episode 6.
Thanks, y'all, for listening. And we will see you next time.